From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Yemen's Houthi rebel leader calls for historic peace talks. Did King Abdullah redefine what it means to be king in Saudi Arabia?
He spoke as if he was just a regular citizen. And one of his favorite lines, in fact, used to be, I'm one of you.
An analyst says President Obama's trip to India had mixed results. And Pakistan and Afghan cooperation is helping battle drug trafficking. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. The leader of Yemen's Shiite Houthi rebels called for a peaceful transfer of power Tuesday, hours after freeing a key presidential aide the rebels held for 10 days. In an appearance on the rebels' television station, Abdel Malik al-Houthi said he invites all free and honorable people to what he called a large, inclusive, and historic meeting Friday in Yemen's capital, Sana'a. Al-Houthi said he is taking a stand against anarchists and those who would rather fight and argue instead of cooperate. The Houthi rebels emerged as the dominant group among those who have wrestled for power since a 2012 popular uprising toppled longtime leader Ali Abdullah Saleh. Barbara Bodine is former U.S. ambassador to Yemen. We asked her whether Yemen will break down into an all-out civil war or become divided between the North and South.
There is a possibility that if no governing structure is created, recreated in Sana'a, and you simply have the Houthis, you have maybe remnants of pro-government forces, and you do have al-Qaeda in the south, and then you also have elements of an armed secession movement, that if you have absolutely no central government whatsoever, that you could end up in a four-sided civil war or a constellation of shifting coalitions among those players. That said, I think that, well, I certainly don't have any evidence of this. The chances of that happening, probably not. The Yemenis have a very strong sense that they're always on the edge of coming apart. They've seen the violence in Somalia, where there was no central government whatsoever, and some other places in the region. And they're painfully aware that they don't want to go there. The question is just, are there any brakes left on the car, or will it simply go over the cliff?
She says the rebels' demands have taken on shape as time goes on.
Originally, it was almost apolitical, and their demands were so unformed that no one knew exactly how to address it. What they say they want is a unified state, which is, I think, the view of the majority of Yemenis. It is the view of a majority of Yemenis. They want a unified state. They want good governance. They want to get rid of corruption. They want to get rid of cronyism. And all of those are things that almost everybody would agree to. What is not clear is really what is the form of that governing structure, and how do you determine the role that a group like the Houthis will play, the role that the Southerners or the South get. That part of their political agenda is still very unformed. What they want is what almost anybody would want. What concerns some people is whether or not they're willing to go back to the political process to legitimize whatever government comes up next, or do they seek to dominate the country?
Is there any room for the U.S. to work with the Houthi rebels in Yemen?
Yes, I do think there is room for us to work with this group, and I think that we have to work with this group. The Houthis are a political reality in Yemen. They were part of the national dialogue, which was the political process following the revolution. Curiously, what they're really demanding is that the government function and that the government do what it's supposed to do. Their reality, we need to deal with them. I think it's also important to note that the Yemeni government officials work with the Houthis, know the Houthis. They're not the same as al-Qaeda. This is a domestic insurgency part of the process as opposed to a outside-the-process terrorist group. We need to talk to them.
Barbara Bodine, former U.S. ambassador to Yemen and the current director of Georgetown University's Institute for the Study of Diplomacy. U.S. President Barack Obama traveled to Saudi Arabia on Tuesday to pay his respects following last week's death of 90-year-old Saudi King Abdullah. Mr. Obama made a brief stop in the capital, Riyadh, while leading a 30-member delegation that included officials and lawmakers, as well as senior officials from previous presidential administrations. While in Riyadh, President Obama and new Saudi King Salman bin Abdulaziz held their first formal talks. U.S. officials and the two leaders discussed a variety of Middle East security concerns and stability on the oil market. Author Fahad Nasser has written an article called "For Saudis, Abdullah Redefined What It Means to Be King." We asked what he meant by that title.
I think that, especially towards the end of his life, I paid very close attention to his speeches, and what I was referring to there is what he said in his speeches, the way he carried himself, the way he conducted himself. I think by most accounts, King Abdullah was liked by many Saudis, and I think maybe the key to that is the way, like I said, the way he carried himself. He seemed very approachable. There was always kind of an air of humility in the way he spoke. He often said, especially in speeches, addressed to Saudis, he said he spoke as if he was just a regular citizen. And one of his favorite lines, in fact, used to be, I'm one of you. And I think the narrative that he tried to build over the years is that every citizen has a role and has to play. Every citizen is a stakeholder, and every citizen has responsibilities and obligations, and so nobody should act as if they're not involved in this bigger nation building endeavor. Nobody should act like a passive bystander.
And you feel he was good at adjusting and bringing along the shifting realities of the Middle East and the modern world.
I do. I think that as militant groups such as ISIS and Al-Qaeda's different offshoots and affiliates have extended, unfortunately, their presence in countries like Syria, Iraq, Yemen, and Nigeria, and other places. The narrative, again, coming from the most senior leaders, political and religious, in Saudi Arabia, including the king himself, they realize that there's a problem, and that militant Islamists were, for lack of a better word, hijacking the religion and presenting a rather skewed or very selective interpretation of Islam. And so in response to that, I think that the Saudis, I think, did a decent job, and it was a concerted effort to dismiss that and to kind of counteract that narrative by emphasizing tolerance and openness and peaceful coexistence, all as central tenets of Islam.
He also maintained an interesting relationship with the United States, although the two countries didn't always agree.
They didn't always agree, but I think there is at least one area where of convergence that I think is very important, and that's in the area of counterterrorism. I think by all accounts, the Saudis and Americans are cooperating very closely and have been for many years encountering. Right now, they both seem to be focused on ISIS or the so-called Islamic State. But prior to that, they have cooperated against other militant groups. There's a sharing of vital intelligence information. I think on at least one occasion, some of that information prevented what could have been a serious terrorist attack inside the United States. They're both cooperating and working hand in hand in military airstrikes against ISIS strongholds in Syria as we speak. So that's all very important. I think the Americans also appreciate the Saudi role, the role that the Saudi Arabia plays in the global energy markets. I think they see it as a stabilizing player. I think that's important common ground. Now, having said that, it's also, many, many people have noted over the past few years since 2011 with the with the events that came to be called as the Arab Spring, I think there was a bit of a divergence there, particularly regarding how the two countries reacted to the events in Egypt. Saudi Arabia viewed former President Hosni Mubarak as a very, very close, reliable ally. And I think there was a bit of a, I think they were disappointed that maybe there was maybe an expectation that the U.S. would support him in more strongly.
Author Fahad Nasser, who is also an analyst with JTG.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
South Asian analyst Michael Kugelman says President Obama's trip to India had mixed results. Writing a blog in today's Wall Street Journal, Kugelman of the Washington-based Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars says the breakthrough in the long-stalled civil nuclear agreement will depend on whether U.S. suppliers are comfortable with the size of the announced $120 million insurance liability pool in case of accidents. Kugelman also says Mr. Modi made a point of saying India remains an independent country, while suggesting New Delhi will not be pressured into a climate change agreement. For his part, Mr. Obama acknowledged the economic relationship is marked by untapped potential, a reference to Indian bureaucratic barriers. Yet security, Kugelman writes, will drive the relationship, including a renewal of a defense framework agreement. The two countries also agreed to a new strategic and commercial dialogue and a renewed effort to reach a bilateral investment treaty. Rajiv Biswas, chief economist at the Singapore-based IHS Global Insight, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the three-day Obama visit was highly successful in strategic terms.
Including in renewable energy, there was significant progress on unblocking bilateral trade in nuclear energy, where there had been concerns by U.S. suppliers about liability issues. And most crucially, there's been a big step forward with the new defense framework agreement between the U.S. and India for another 10 years. And very importantly, it'll be much deeper and stronger than the previous 10-year agreement. This is very important from both countries' perspectives because I think India will be a very important partner for the U.S. in terms of the Asia-Pacific security dimension, both maritime security and cooperation in many other areas. Certainly from India's point of view, the U.S. will also be a very crucial partner in India's fight against terrorism. So I think the strengthening of intelligence cooperation will also be very crucial, and that has been agreed. So there's a lot of positives that are coming out of this visit.
His vision is that India and the U.S. develop a true global partnership. Is this a way to counterbalance a rising China?
I think that's a perspective one can take on this, and I think certainly from the defense point of view, India is keen not to be completely technologically outmatched by China. But on the other hand, I think India also wants to keep a relatively even hand between its relations with China and with the U.S. It doesn't want to engage in an arms race with China. So I think they're also looking to build their economic relations with China. But I think the dimension that is in much greater focus with India's relations with the U.S. is on defense cooperation, and certainly one of the perspectives for that is in relation to potential technological challenges from China's very rapidly growing military capability. And of course, India also has had a number of wars with Pakistan, so they need to be prepared for any threats that could come on that side.
Rajiv, Mr. Obama, speaking to U.S. and Indian corporate leaders, said the economic relationship is also defined by untapped potential. Is this primarily a swipe at India's barriers to a greater U.S. investment?
I think in the past, India has had barriers to investment by other countries, and I think that Prime Minister Modi is going to be trying to gradually reduce some of those barriers although he won't dismantle everything. If we look at bilateral trade between the U.S. and India, it has grown very rapidly. It's now reached a level of about $100 billion per year, but still, I think that's very much below what it ought to be given the size of both countries. But I think India is now going through a period when growth is going to accelerate. I think Indian economic growth is probably going to get back up to about 7 to 8% per year. Based on that, I think there's going to be huge opportunities for U.S. multinationals to build up their exports to India quite substantially. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see a doubling of bilateral trade within the next decade. And some of the components of that will certainly be on military equipment. It's clear that there's now going to be an escalation of bilateral trade on defense equipment, commercial aerospace. India's domestic passenger movements by air transport are also growing very rapidly. And then there's the whole area of infrastructure and power equipment. That was a big focus of President Obama's visit, how the U.S. can provide more equipment in various aspects of power, whether nuclear power, renewable energy, and also conventional energy, fossil fuel-related power generation.
Biswal expects the Indian consumer market to grow more rapidly over the next decade than the 8% he expects in India's gross domestic product. He says it may even surpass China's consumer growth, which is moderating. Increasing counterterrorism and border security cooperation between Pakistan and Afghanistan has raised hopes for more effective anti-drug regional efforts. Ayaz Ghul reports from Islamabad.
Despite significant international investment to counter illicit drug production in Afghanistan, a recent UN survey says the country has seen a surge in poppy cultivation area for a third consecutive year. Pakistani authorities say the increase in Afghan drugs coupled with the withdrawal of the bulk of NATO forces from the war-shattered country poses even a bigger challenge to their counter-narcotics efforts. Pakistan Anti-Narcotics Force head Major General Khawar Hanif told a UN-sponsored international conference in Islamabad, continued international involvement is needed to tackle the Afghan drug problem.
Thankfully, the commitment of the present Afghan government with respect to border control arrangements and counter-narcotic efforts is quite palpable. However, we believe that unless there is a wholehearted support from the international community proportionate to the drug problem, the region is going to remain in the same crisis. Abandoning our Afghan colleagues to deal with this overwhelming poppy cultivation and drug production is not an option at all.
Pakistan shares a 2,500-kilometer mostly porous border with Afghanistan. General Hanif says the terrain poses challenges to the country's fight against terrorism and drugs trafficking.
A lot of divided villages, as you can see on the borders, facilitate in movement across the border both ways. And you actually enter into a village from one country and get out in the other. There are more than 200 unfrequented routes in which practically there are no law enforcement agencies present.
Representative for the UN Anti-Drugs Office in Pakistan, Cesar Gudez, says the alarming drug situation in the region requires enhanced joint efforts.
I think that is the key element for success in combating drugs trafficking in this part of the world. The main producing country plus the main transit country need to strengthen their efforts effectively, very professionally, and with all the sectors in both countries joining efforts to tackle this regional problem.
He says the preferred market of the Afghan narcotics is Europe, and Pakistan serves as the main transit route.
It's approximately 45 to 50% of the opiates produced in Afghanistan that use Pakistan as a preferred stepping stone on Western international market. Then about 30% goes via the Islamic Republic of Iran, and the balance, 20-something percent, via the Central Asian republics onwards to Russia and Europe.
Pakistani officials say the proliferation of Afghan drugs has also led to an increase in drug addiction in Pakistan. Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yaki in Washington.
This is Today in History. On January 28th, 814, Charlemagne, also known as Charles the Great, King of the Franks, died. Charlemagne attempted to bring order and stability to Europe through a series of conquests and reforms. At the end of a 30-year military campaign, he was the undisputed ruler of much of Western Europe. On this day in 1521, the Diet of Worms began, lasting until May 25th. The deliberative assembly of the Holy Roman Empire met to consider what to do about the Protestant Reformation. On this day in 1596, Sir Francis Drake, privateer and first Englishman to circumnavigate the world, died off the coast of Spanish-held Puerto Rico. A bane to the Spanish, Drake was instrumental in the defeat of the Spanish-led Armada off the English coast in 1588. In 1807, pell-mell in London became the world's first city street lighted with gas. The illumination made travel safer and reduced crime, so the popularity of gas street lighting quickly increased. On this day in 1871, Prussian forces converged on Paris during the Franco-Prussian War, laying siege to the French capital for more than 4 months until the French agreed to surrender. On this day in 1915, the U.S. Coast Guard was established by an act of Congress and signed by President Woodrow Wilson. In 1965, the current maple leaf design of the flag of Canada was proclaimed by Queen Elizabeth after approval by the Canadian Parliament. The flag was officially inaugurated the following month. And on January 28, 1986, the U.S. Space Shuttle Challenger exploded 73 seconds after liftoff. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Democratic Republic of Congo's parliament has enacted a national election law after dropping a provision that many feared would delay next year's presidential election and had sparked days of deadly protests. Political tensions were eased and further demonstrations were called off after the Senate scrapped language in a version of the law approved earlier by the lower house that would have delayed the voting until a national census could be conducted. Opposition leaders and some political activists charged that it was intended to delay the ballot and allow President Joseph Kabila to remain in power beyond the constitutionally set limit of 2 terms in office. According to local and international human rights groups, dozens of people were killed in violent street clashes over several days of demonstrations, during which Congolese security forces allegedly fired live ammunition into crowds of protesters. There are reports that hundreds of individuals rounded up during the protests remain in detention. Parliament approved the revised measure on January 25th, and election plans will proceed concurrently with a national headcount. The United States welcomes the approval of the current electoral legislation, which sets the country on course toward timely elections in line with the DRC's constitution. We applaud the efforts of the National Assembly and the Senate to reach consensus and ensure that presidential elections take place by December 2016. We urge President Kabila to expeditiously sign the bill as passed by the parliament and reaffirm that Congo's first peaceful transition of power will take place in 2016. We also call upon the National Independent Electoral Commission to promptly release a global electoral calendar that is in line with Parliament's vote and the Constitution. The actions the DRC Parliament has taken, along with President Kabila's expected signature, represent critical, albeit initial, steps towards national elections in 2016 and what could be the country's first peaceful transfer of power in its almost 55 years since independence. We encourage all Congolese stakeholders, including the government, opposition, and civil society, to use this opportunity to undertake a peaceful, transparent, and inclusive dialogue about the electoral process moving forward. We stand ready to support the DRC in this process.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.